Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2018 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
All right, today we're going to talk about powerful study tools. And this is Judy Monday, working on powerful study tools and alternative assessments. And this is what I want to start with is a very foundational concept, because it leads so importantly into the whole understanding of what's going on as your child is going through a learning process. And children with special struggles in learning end up getting stuck anywhere along this process, because when we want to teach a child, the first thing they have to do is acquire what we're saying. And that may be what they hear, what they read, but the first process in learning is simply acquiring. You're listening to me right now. If you have a hearing defect, you might not be able to acquire what I have to say. If you had something on the screen you couldn't read, it would limit what you could acquire. Then once they get it, they've got to store it. Somehow it goes right into short-term memory, which is the first step in the process, and that's usually a few seconds long. And hopefully at that point, that's the process where it can either get garbled or dropped or mixed up, fall out of sequence, but it's got to go through that step. So we may have to address how we want to help them move from acquiring to storing it. Now, the organization process is a key part, and this is where oftentimes kids with processing issues begin to struggle, because in organizing it, we either have to associate it with something we're familiar with, or something we've just learned or just read. It's a process of connecting the dots so that it makes sense. It's not just enough to have it in our short-term memory and then leave it lying there in outer space somewhere. So the organization is something we really need to do. And for kids who have any kind of a learning struggle, it becomes our job to systematically talk to them about how to organize, to show them this connects to what you've already just learned about algae, or this connects to what you've just learned about the other short A vowel words. You have to make it explicit and show them these things look the same. Let's see that this is another A-N-T word. Finally, where we often see the kids have trouble is in retrieving it, because the way we often ask them to retrieve it is something that may not be at their strong suit. So we may ask them to write it, and they may be dysgraphic. We may ask them to say it orally, but they're not even able to necessarily do that, and we have to ask them to point to it. Or we may ask them to show us rather than ask them to do something with pencil and paper. But then we also want it to be automatic. I've now heard a lot of parents who share with me that their child has problems with times facts, for example. And a lot of the curricula push doing them fast, the time drills. Well, is that a hill that we need to really die for? Can we just settle for the fact that they know them and take them a little bit more time? The thinking when I was in grad school back in 1968 was that when you look at having a child who takes more than 3 seconds per times fact, it begins to become cumulatively longer and longer to finish a multi-step problem like long division. So the goal was that the speed was an important component. But I've seen after 30 years of working with struggling learners that the speed may not be the critical variable we really need to push forward. And I will often tell parents if they can't get their times fact back automatically by age 9 or 10, let's move to a calculator, because the process is more about the learning the math. So it may not be something you want to push hard. So what may cause a child to have some issues with any of those four key variables? First of all, they need the pre-skills. And oftentimes I think we jump in because the curriculum's moving faster than they are. But I like this little diagram because we have all different kinds of things. They need to be able to hear. They may need to have pre-skills here. They may not be able to read. May not have trouble with the book. I love this little guy with a scratch in his head. But they need to have basic skills. They need to have language comprehension. They sometimes need to be able to express what they know. That's a language skill. Their reading may be weak. They may not be able to follow a sequence of steps. And that gets bigger and bigger as they get older. Because, of course, when you're doing long division, that's got one of the most complex set of steps. It's everything from, does this go into this number, and is my answer bigger than or less than the next guy? Then where do I put my answer, and where do I do the multiplying around? There's loads of steps that are all very subtle. So sometimes I want you to have to just stop and think about what is the pre-skill that may be in fact not in play. In cases with kids with dyslexia, I'll hear the parents going through the process of troubleshooting and thinking about maybe it's a vision problem. Vision is a component of good reading, but dyslexia happens in the neurology. It's not the same. But if you find that vision is an issue, absolutely, it's a skill they need to have. So you still want to go ahead and get the eyeglasses checked. So to ensure your child does learn, you've got to ask if your child has the pre-skills, but you also want to stick and say, am I introducing too much all at one time? Because sometimes the lessons include a bunch of new things that you're trying to cover all at once. So you may have to step back and pull it. When I was teaching my daughter to cook, I was one who had been cooking since I was 8 years old. To me, it was just kind of this global thing. Sarah had to have the ingredients all laid out on the counter. It would make me crazy, but she was a one step at a time cook. She had to do it sequentially, and she had to have everything organized right in front of her. But if I tried to just get her to jump in and start mixing, it was too much to do all at one time. So I had to get her to back up and learn one skill at a time. Sometimes we find that kids cannot tell you that they're ready to move on, and you look at what they're working on, and you're not sure. Do they really have it? And you think they've got it, and you move to the next step, and they begin to struggle. Because a lot of learning is very cumulative. You know, it builds one thing on the next, on the next, on the next, on the next. And then sometimes you have to assemble other things around to go with it. All right, now, what are some elements of good instruction? One is that experts show students perform better when they know exactly what you are looking for. And you may think, well, I told him we're going to talk about reading today, but that may not be specific enough. We may be reading to find out how many bears were in Goldilocks Cottage. It might be a simple statement like that, or it might be today we're going to look at subtracting and learning how to do this. But if you tell them what you're looking for, it makes it easier for them. For older students, I've given you something in your handout, and I wish I had more time to cover this in my workshop, but I don't. It's called a rubric. If you have people who are in the military, people who are in the job market, the boss gives them a statement of what their job performance is going to be evaluated on. And they state, these are the elements that we're going to keep up with you on. And across the top, you define what that performance level should look like. Now, I have one in my book on handwriting, because that's a big one. We start with our kids printing. One of the elements that I would put is, are my letters on the line? Are my letters all the same size? Are my letters spaced evenly? So I've given them the criteria, and then across the top, I'll tell them, two or three letters off the line would be an A. Three or four letters off the line would be a B, and so on. So I've stated my expectations, and they can look at their own work and say, yeah, I've got this, Mom, and they begin to internalize their own learning performance. So the rubric is a very important element in setting the child up for what you're asking. Sometimes the rubric just helps you. You may not need to give it to the child, but it's important for you to state ahead of time what you want them to do. The results can be measured objectively. A lot of the public school IEPs that I have seen recently are, Johnny will learn to appreciate literature. What's objective about that? I mean, the teacher could say anything she wants about whether Johnny can read or not. Johnny's going to make progress in first grade math, stating how and what. So if it's objective, then you can say, Johnny can do 7 out of 10 first grade math problems. Now I've got an objective standard and I know what I'm looking for. See the difference? And that encourages your heart, because then you can begin to say, I feel confident I know where my child is. And am I doing something that's going in the right direction, or do I need to change course? Because that's often important. And I want you to think of teaching your child at home like making a road trip. And as you go, you've got markers along the highway that give you direction on where you are. And you know whether you need to change and get off the road, take a detour, go back and start from the beginning again, look at the map. Think of moving along, but always be checking where you are on that roadmap of where you want to go. Now, this one is so important, and maybe I ought to retitle this slide, Thinking Outside the Box, because I know a lot of you are not just teaching one child at a time, but you want to individualize. So you may have to ask different kinds of questions. There's a young man that's been coming up to me. I think he's probably spent at least 45 minutes in front of my booth talking to my friend and me. And he says he's bored. And what am I hearing? I'm hearing a kid who's so bright, he wants more. So when mom's teaching the lesson, instead of just giving him the basic in the book, send him off to do a project, or send him off to look online and do a Wikipedia search, or to do a model of it, something to enrich his curriculum rather than just doing exactly what the book says and no more. So you can do that just by giving him something else to run with while you're working on the other child who needs more individual attention. You may need to, in the other direction, simplify what you're asking. And I said this yesterday, forgive me those of you who are repeating, but we often over-talk. When we're trying to explain something, we go on and we go on and we go on and we change the language and we explain it a different way again. Make your expectations simple. State what you want as shortly as possible. Cut back the language you use, because a lot of the kids with language-related learning disabilities are almost at an invisible learning disability. You almost don't notice it as such, but they get lost. Clear example of that would be when I'm working with a child who's struggling to learn to read. And instead of they've sounded out, mask, and I say, all right, tell me the word. What have I just done? I've added a whole lot of extra stuff in their brain that they've got to erase for the moment so that they can tell me the word. So I go, mask, what word? And I don't overload them. And eventually they learn to just read when I point or do a symbol, so that the only thing that's operating is a minimum of language and what they need to do to blend that word together. So you can drown your kid with talking too much, honest. You can modify your reading requirements. That's an easy one. You don't need me to explain that. Performance tasks are another item where you can go outside the box. The performance tasks are anything simple from making a model, giving a speech, making a drawing instead. I often use pictures on the backside of vocabulary cards instead of written definitions. A lot of the kids that I work with dyslexia are very good with art, but it's very hard for them to repeat a dictionary definition that has words they don't understand anyway. So we talk about the definition, and I ask him to draw what will help you remember what that is about. That works for history, that works for social studies, for science. It's a good vocabulary option. Supporting with scaffolding. When I use the term scaffolding, it's an educational term, but you've seen it on a lot of buildings when they're building a new big superstructure and they have the scaffolding on the outside. What's the scaffolding for? It's not going to be a permanent part of the structure. It's to support the walls until the walls can stand on their own. So you need to be thinking of yourself as giving just enough support to get them to where they can become independent, but remove bits of scaffolding as they are able to move to the next level. And that can often be as simple as saying the word before you ask them to read it out loud, doing the math problem for them and say, your turn. So the scaffolding can be very minor. Other times it can be far more involved, and I've got lots of ideas in my book, but I'll give you one. If your child has trouble remembering vocabulary words and you're doing a test, the scaffolding can be put a list of the words he needs to know down the side of the page. He doesn't have to bring them back from a vacuum. You've given him just enough support that he sees the word and can choose it. That's a scaffolding item. I've supported him, but I haven't made him work from his weakness. Does that make sense? Use technology when you can. Please don't be afraid of technology. You can put limits on safety issues for technology anywhere today. Now, you don't have to worry about the kids going in the wrong direction, but there's so much technology. I've talked to a number of moms during this conference already who have kids that have dysgraphia. They're bright, they have a lot to say, but their handwriting is just painfully tedious and slow. If they're over about 9 or 10 years old, give them a typewriter or let them dictate. I mean, I can talk to my phone and it prints out what I say. So your child can talk to his phone and print out what you want him to say. Or talk to his computer. Almost every computer these days now has what's called either speech recognition or speech to text. Hook them up. I often will challenge the kids to do that, and then I will sit down with them. And my scaffolding is to go through very systematically the grammar, analyzing the periods, the capital letters. But that's my job. It's their job to put down what they have to say. Now, praise needs to be very specific. And I had a mother, and I mentioned this yesterday, so some of you can forgive me on this. But her primary correction to her kids when I would watch her work with them was just to say no.
No what?
What's wrong with it? I don't know. You just said no. They'd answer a question, but they had no idea what was incorrect or what was right. So when I went through my master's at the University of Illinois back in the 60s, one of the things we learned was that praise needs to be specific. I love the way you kept those letters on the line. I love the way you got those numbers in the right column for your long division. I love the way you put that thought into words for me because it gives me a new way of thinking about what you've said. It's very, very specific. And then after I've given them specific praise, I do the sandwich hamburger thing. I've told them what I like. One thing is something I pick up to correct, only one. I don't dump on them all the other things that are wrong. We'll pick one thing. And then at the bottom, I'll say, but even when you've done that, you've done a very nice job on, and tell them what. You don't just say, good work, because good work doesn't help them to appreciate the specific thing that you're aiming for. Words can be as effective as tangible rewards, but there are kids who benefit more from getting a tangible reward. They earn tokens, they earn credits, they earn a trip to McDonald's if they get X number of problems right on their math worksheet. You know, you'll find what motivates your child. My youngest grandchild, she's 11 now, her idea of a reward is to work for 15 minutes and let's go outside. That's what she works for. She's happy to work for going outside. But now that we know what that magic is, we have something we can use to keep her going. Now, the other thing that I think, for particularly this is truer of older kids, but I'm seeing more and more younger kids become anxious and very worried, particularly they develop a perfectionist kind of a tendency. When they make a mistake, they kind of just globally crash. I'm stupid, I'm no good, I'm a failure, I'll never get this. But you can begin to try to systematically show, and this is where you don't dump on all their errors at once, what can we learn about how to do it right the next time? What are you going to focus on next time? It may be that you highlight it. It may be that you let them write it again on a big whiteboard this high. But find a way to let them see, what will you do next time that's going to be better? What did I do? What did I do wrong? What can I do next time? And it becomes such a powerful encouragement to their soul. Feedback. You can enrich with extra facts, enrich feedback using examples, but make it specific. Always add something helpful. And when you're correcting, do not grade their paper at the top with how many they got wrong. It's how many did they get right. You got 9 out of 10. Good for you. You got 4 out of 8. Well, you know and I know that's 50%, and that's a clue to me that I've got to do some more teaching. But I don't need to focus and beat that into them. I can say, you got 4 of these right. Look at them. And point to the success. So monitoring progress is your job as a teacher. How do you do that? It's easy to get lost, especially when you've got more than one child going on at the same time, but try to keep track of some sort of a record of objective data. Like last week, his math quiz showed that he was only getting 3 out of 10, so addition problems, right? That's telling me objectively. I can go back and look at that so that 2 weeks later when he's at 8 out of 10, check for me. I've done a good job of making some progress in this area, so I can move on. You can use charts, you can use graphs, you can use grading that your child understands. The rubrics, I've got some that I've seen where there are just happy faces, smiley face, sad face, tears, and I usually don't say, you fail, I say, do over. But it's a rubric the child can see. They know what they've got, the grade makes sense to them. And again, use objective standards and not how you feel, because it's up to you. You're driving. You've got to know where you're going and whether you're making progress down the road. Also, when you've got older kids, the records and the research also show the research that performance increases when students reflect on their own work. I'm talking middle school now and up, okay? I'm not just the little guys. But they can take responsibility for that learning and set some goals. What would you like to do at the end of this paper? What are you hoping to learn? And I've seen some workshops descriptions for this convention here that look like they would move kids toward being able to do that and beginning to start thinking about their own learning. Again, the setting the standards. I've found parents who really like creating a rubric because it helps them to structure where they're going and decide what's important about this assignment instead of being globally overwhelmed because I don't know where I'm trying to go. I had a mom who, her son was basically cerebral palsied and he had some concerns, and the school basically sent him home and told mom, you know, there just isn't much chance that he's really going to be much of a student. Well, I told Mom about rubrics, and this mom went rubric crazy. Every assignment she gave him, she had a rubric. And she brought me the reports at the end of the year. She brought me 4 boxes of the rubric she had done with him the entire school year. But that child was on grade level. Yeah, because she knew how he was doing and she could keep track. But I said, honey, we've only got an hour appointment. I can't do all of this with you and do an end of the year evaluation. But she had discovered a magic trick for her that worked. And it gave her a sense of purpose and focus and how to direct where she was going. So now I told you we're going to talk about power tools. One of the things that's really effective is finding out what works for what your child does best. And sometimes that affects with how they handle new learning. Sometimes you have to go back and think about what they used to know and what they did know. And probably the synonym for being a special ed teacher is being flexible. And you're often, probably most of you moms of a child who's got some struggling learners, so it means being flexible. Now that flexibility can come in a number of different ways. It may mean drop the idea of where you went to school and what that schoolroom looked like and what it felt like and where you had to sit at a desk as opposed to sitting on a cushion on the chair, lying on your back, jumping on a trampoline, but find where your child can do the best. I had to learn my own younger son needed to listen to music to do his best. He was a very, very bright kid, but he had an ADD brain, along with a few other things. And he absolutely had to listen to music to get his brain working. All right. So think outside the box. And this one I talked about earlier already, where you want to wean your students to becoming independent by pulling back some on the support and the scaffolding you give. Eventually, as a child begins to get to middle school year, they can begin to create their own monitoring. And I would do this with some of my learning disabilities classrooms in the public school where I would have them graph their own grades. And I remember there was one period we went through where they were complaining that they didn't think they'd gotten good grades. And I said, well, let's graph how much your grade is compared to how many hours you studied your spelling lists. It was pretty revealing. The ones who had studied like 30 minutes or 15 minutes, their grades were down there, but as their study time increased, they could see their own grades go up. So that monitoring was helpful for them to become aware that they had a role in it. Because a lot of students who have special needs get to what's called learned helplessness. And that learned helplessness begins to incapacitate them that no matter what I do, it's not going to make a difference. So the more you can put forward for them the evidence that what they're doing does make a change, the more you empower them to have that internal drive, which is the thing that often most of them will give up on very early. And again, we talked about making. All right, so we're going to organize information. We said acquiring information, storing it. This is something that I think we assume and understand why, because for most of us it was pretty natural that we just went through life and we kind of got what there was to say. But you may have to teach your child how to organize information into like kinds. And that can be starting at beginning of reading, where you show them that the short A words all have the same A sound. You may teach them that animals belong into birds that fly, animals that fly, animals that swim. That's a sorting task. But as they acquire new information, you've given them a box that you can kind of help them connect that, and it makes it easier to retrieve because you've shown them how to sort it. That can follow all the way to high school, where you're teaching them about people in a particular period of history, and you've named the generals on one side of the war, the generals on the other side, the people that were neutral, and they've got to sort that out and make sense of it, because otherwise the whole picture of that science thing or that history thing makes no sense because they have nowhere to fit it in a context. But you have to be explicit and show them, these are the reasons I'm putting these guys here. They were all British generals. These were all American generals. These were all people who participated from France and otherwise. So I'm helping them to say, there's an attribute that makes sense here. And sorting and how to find those attributes is particularly difficult for kids who are on the autism spectrum because they tend to look at the trees and not the big picture. So if you've got a child who's on the autism spectrum, it's really tricky to get them to focus on a particular attribute because they'll get stuck on that attribute and they won't be able to generalize it out to other things that share the same attribute. If you're looking at trees and you want to teach them about pine trees, what is it that makes it a pine tree and not a tree that has leaves? Well, we have to talk about it. We can't just expect him to see it. It's a forest, okay, Mom, I got it. It's a forest. Or it's a pine tree, but I don't see that a pine tree has much to do with the other trees in the forest. And so I have to walk him through what it is that I'm looking at to help him go through that. So again, do this directly, but focus on one attribute at a time. Now, one of the things that I used was this particular little sorting chart with younger children. And eventually, at first, I just give them the list of animals. And then I ask them to even develop the names of the categories. After they get good at sorting, then I ask them, all right, we've got whales, we've got dogs, we've got fish, we've got a racehorse, we've got a cat and a robin. What categories can I sort these into? Well, they're all animals that breathe, but let's make a category for them. You're teaching them how to think critically so that when they get to more advanced information, it makes more sense. Okay, this is a simple one that I developed. Where does that flower in the middle go? I can talk to them about it. What am I looking at? Well, yeah, they're all flowers, but why does it belong with one group as opposed to another? It's a very elementary young child thing, but you can do that with babies. You know, 2-3 years old, where does that go? Now, the classic that you guys all probably heard when you were in school was the classic Venn diagram with the little overlapping circles. And yes, it's to teach similarities and differences, but I almost always get terribly inferior work because they can't fit the similarities in that little writing space. You know, and it's awful, you can't read it. So I developed an alternative. They can put the similarities in the box and the unique attributes of one and the unique attributes of the other. And then what you put in the similarities box becomes the paragraph they write. So they can pick their examples from A, they can pick their examples from B, and they unify it. But you're teaching them, again, critical thinking and how to organize information. But this does not give me inferior work. This I can read, they can read, and they're more willing to be expansive about what they do. And you can play this, make a chart of it on the floor if you want with younger kids and give them a bunch of blocks and say, let's sort them into two piles. Put the red ones here, you put the blue ones here. How are they all alike? Well, they're all blocks. And it's a very, very foundational but beginning thinking process. Now, kids on the spectrum will have already decided a lot of those things because they'll have lined up all the blue blocks, and then they'll line up all the yellow blocks, and then they'll line up all the red blocks, and then they'll go back to the blue ones again. My grandkid was doing that at about 1.5, and I thought, oh, he's so brilliant. But I didn't know about autism yet. I mean, I'd been in special ed, and I had taught 20-odd years and had one autistic child in one of my public school classrooms, and that was the only one I had seen until I had one of my own. So we have to work again with that scaffolding to working to help them work with abstract information. So you have to kind of almost create these concepts. And because they often have an information, because they often focus on science kinds of information, you've got an up in the sense that you can begin focusing them more on technology or on science-related information, and that's going to help them kind of prosper in their thinking about science and categories or engineering or whatever it is that they're working on. The science often can be a door to get you into doing some of these skills. Okay, now the caution. Grammar is a highly abstract concept. It's not a concrete kind of thinking because the words take on their attributes based on their context and where they're used in the sentence, whether they're a proper noun, a common noun. There's so many different variables that make the grammar what it is. And outlining, unfortunately, isn't the same thing. So I have pretty much given up teaching grammar to kids with learning disabilities. I know that may be scandalous, but I will go for the mechanics of capitalization, punctuation, good sentence structure that sounds like the way an adult, intelligent person would talk. But to try and say, you know, this is an interrogative pronoun, dependent clause, there's a lot of that pre-skill stuff that isn't in place to get there. So is it a hill you want to die for? I happened to do it and loved it when I was in high school. To me, that was just like, that was fun. That was part of the day that I just enjoyed doing. But I began to realize more and more as I worked with the older kids who had the learning disabilities, it was just too much. And it's not a hill I wanted to die for because I wanted them to write good sentences that explained what was on their mind. So I didn't choose to say, you know, find me the nouns, find me the verbs, find me the helping verbs, find me the subjunctive clause. It just didn't help. If you choose to do it, however, you can use this sorting idea where you write the words and you ask them to put them in columns. If you choose to go for some parts of speech, you can still do some basic parts of speech because we do want them maybe to know that nouns get capital letters sometimes. They kind of have to know it's the name of a person, place, or thing. Unfortunately, a lot of kids with learning disabilities have a language problem and they can't even remember that little definition. It's a person, place, thing, or idea. What makes an idea an idea? Can you quickly define for me what an idea makes an idea? It's hard to explain. You and I know kind of, yeah, it's an idea. But how do I communicate what's an idea to a child? Or the abstract concept of liberty. Can't hold it, can't touch it, but we know we've got it. It's a concept. So there are all these different abstract properties that are necessary to really successfully execute grammar. So why make that the hill you're going to die for when you really want them to be just able to write answers to questions and so on? Now, this is not revelatory, but practice does build mastery. Homework differs from elementary to high school, that's obvious. And special needs kids may need help or accommodations. Sometimes that help may mean that you actually give them the times tables so that they can look at them. My grandson now is getting accommodations on extra time to take the SATs. He's apparently just earned on his ACTs a score that could get him into Harvard. But when he takes it again, he's going to have extra time because he freezes. His autism and OCD just freeze him out and he cannot get started quickly and easily, so he's going to have extra time to take that test to show what he knows. And I want you to think of accommodations not as crutches, but as an accommodation to help them show what they know. Any way that they can show it, we want to help them show what they know. That's the whole point of what we're teaching. Can they show it? Can they use it? Can they apply it? Can I make it available to them in a way that they can also show me what they've learned? We talked about explaining the purpose at the beginning, but please don't assign work if you're not going to give feedback on it. Don't just take papers and take papers and take papers and not give any feedback, because you're just wasting their time. I'm sorry, but really, it's not benefiting them at all if you're not giving them feedback. Just writing stuff doesn't tell them whether they've learned it. So homework has to be having feedback. Okay, so strategies for helping reading comprehension. One of the best things I've found for helping students who have problems reading comprehension is to read the questions first. Even for little guys, tell them what you're reading for. How many bears did they have in the cottage when Goldilocks came home? Well, there weren't any at the beginning, but they came in later. But it's a question that I ask them before she starts reading. Discuss the pictures, the charts, and the maps. Most good textbooks, and I have to say I've seen some that are not educationally solid in terms of how they help the students, but look for textbooks, and this is the whole chapter I wrote in my book on choosing effective construction curriculum. It should have supports for the students. It should have a list of vocabulary. It should have a check of regular review sections as you go through the chapter rather than waiting till the end and giving them 30 questions. Walk through it with them so that they look at the maps. Does the map help you make sense out of what's in that paragraph? Oh, yeah, now I see where that was. It builds on some of their visual strengths, and a lot of these kids do have visual strengths. Show them how to highlight key ideas. No surprise here, when I introduce kids to highlighting, they often highlight everything. So you have to kind of back off and get them to slow down. When you're going through reading comprehension, have the student read or listen, and you may have to help them learn how to study by summarizing. Summarizing can be very hard. You may have to actually write down the key ideas as they're going and say, now, how can we put this into a sentence or two? All right, this one is one of the ones that I have found has helped the most in reading comprehension and improvement for the students that I've taught over the years. And it's so basic, and yet it's so effective. If you have a child who's taking piano, or a child who's taking soccer, a child who has some other skill that they like, how do we encourage them to get better? Practice. Why not practice academic skills? Okay, so instead of reading every new passage aloud and judging that's their reading skill, They've never seen the material. If I gave you some technical educational journals or something and I asked you to read them out loud, we would not feel as confident in your reading skill probably, because some of the vocabulary would be very unfamiliar. We do that to our kids every time we say, let's read aloud. So we give them this paragraph, 100, 150 words long, and they read it out loud. And it's more fun if you tape them the first time they go through it and say, I want to see how you do when you get better after you practice, because I want you to hear the difference. And now we've got video cameras. When I first came up with this idea, we had tape recorders with little push buttons. So I ask them to practice, and I say, I want you to sound like you talk. I want you to read it just the way you sound like when you talk. So tell me when you're ready, and we're going to tape you again. Lo and behold, the reading sounds like fluent reading. But what's cool that the research shows is, A, it improves comprehension up to sometimes a whole grade level in one school year, 5-10 minutes a day. But it also improves their ability to read with expression, because they're not reading words, they're reading ideas. That's where the comprehension comes from. It's reading ideas. You can also lead into this by reading aloud for them so they know what it should sound like. Because oftentimes they're reading a conversation, and conversations are harder to read because you've got to sound like you're the person who's really saying the story. The little boy was reading about a rocket about to not land properly on the moon. And he's decoding the story, and the shuttle is fast approaching the moon, and the astronaut says, oh my, we may crash, and he goes on and he keeps on reading at this monotone level with some chops and stuff. I said, is that what the astronaut's going to sound like when he's about to crash? No, he's going to scream, we're about to crash! So I read it to him with expression, and lo and behold, from that point on, I never had a problem with him reading with expression. He finally was reading as if it was really the story. But he had not heard anybody read it like that to him, I guess. So you model because you're the leader, and you don't have to hand it all to them. But as they're reading and improving here, they're also seeing the words over and over again, so those words become more familiar the next time they see them in new locations. But they're not drilling the, and. It's just in the context of making sense. So you've improved their reading on several key ways. And audiobooks are a good support system if you've got several children in the same situation where you need to be working individually with several of your children. You can find the books on tape. You can use Reading Ally, you can read naturally, look online, you can find almost all the ways to find books that are available on tape. That's a good point. Now, as I shared yesterday and you heard me tell the story, I had a math learning disability. Didn't know it, I just thought I was dumb. I was getting A's in almost everything except conduct. Drove my father crazy. But I was an ADD kid. I was bored, and I was reading books, and I wasn't behaving in class, but I had a math learning disability, and I would lose all my recesses staying inside practicing times facts on the chalkboard because I couldn't remember them. So I got to first year algebra and I failed it. Took it the second time, got a C minus. I went on to college thinking I was just not very smart, but I thought I just had lucked by. I got to be age 40, was ready to get my teaching license, and they said, in Virginia, you've got to have a college math class to teach and get a certificate. And I went, there go two master's degrees right down the drain. I'm not going to be able to teach because I can't do math. So I walk in my college math class. I knew I had to try. My family literally pushed me out the door by hand. I mean, literally locked the door behind me. And I walk into the class, and there's Aunt Jemima. No joke, she was with Aunt Jemima. And she stands there like this, and she looks at the class, and she says, I know why y'all are here. You didn't get it the first time, did you? And she said, I've got news, good news for you, because I'm going to show you how to do math. I am going to answer any questions. There will be no dumb questions. I will stay with you until you get it. And I did. I walked home with an A at the end of that class, and I was flying. But there was one night I hadn't studied for a test. I had a cannonball on my stomach this big. I was so scared to sit down and take that test because I knew I hadn't had time to study. I'd had sick kids. I still know that fear. So when I get a student who can't do math, I'm right there. But this is the strategy that she taught that helped me the most. And I want to share it with you because it's been so powerful in my life. When your child gets a new math operation, and I don't care what grade level you're working on, you have to talk them through the steps, because the steps are what matter. The number facts can be put on a study card. You can give them a number facts chart. It's the steps that's going to throw them off. They're going to lose the ability to follow the steps. So you walk them through it. What are they doing first? What are they doing next? What are they doing next? You guide them through the sample, but here's what makes the difference. Again, like I said about practice, the same problem over and over. By the third or fourth time, the number facts are now familiar. They don't have to be thinking about that, but they're thinking about, where do I write the number? Where do I put the carry number? Where do I do the adding? And what's the sequence of the steps that I need to be following? And it works, because then you've built a mastery level that carries to the next problem. The trick is that many math books tend to switch into another kind of problem, the second problem, and then you've lost the benefit. Good question. When you've used that process to begin, you make sure that they're mastering the steps on that. So the second problem you give them is just a slightly different problem. Exactly. Again, you're following the steps. That's a good question. Thank you for clarifying. So you continue this process, and gradually, as you see the mastery develop, you increase the difficulty level, but you've given them the foundation of the steps. And that's the key. They need the key to the steps. When my husband began to teach me, it was more like a language. And every time you did a math problem, you were really making a statement that's true. I could understand the point of it, and I could understand that there were steps I had to follow, like a recipe when I cook. Recipes. I'm good at recipes. I can do recipes. So if I have got a recipe to do this problem, I know how to do the steps. And I could follow that. This is an example from a book that I wish to goodness I could get on my own. It's a problem book that does a lot of scaffolding. And I told you about scaffolding. But if you look at the top line, you can see that they have walked the child pro. Now, if I were giving this to the child, I'd be saying, all right, let's talk about this. We've multiplied 6 times 2. I put my ones digit and I take my 10 into the tens column. All right, I've added 5 times 2 and now I have to add 1. And so I write it. So they've shown them all the steps. Now down here, they've done the same thing. But see, they've started by eliminating just a little bit of the support over there. And now the child is more independent. See how they do it? It's a book called SLAM. And the only existing copy I can find on Amazon is $200. But it was written back in the 1970s, but I love the concept, and you can kind of create some of those same similar graduated support things that you do on just graph paper. All right, fluent writing. This is a tough one for a lot of students, and it may not be possible, so you have to explore ways to show the child what he's learned. I've talked with some people yesterday. We try reducing the assignment quantity. Oftentimes we go through this, and I'm going to take one of my pieces of paper. And when I'm trying to reduce the quantity, I'll take a piece of paper like this, and I will divide the paper in 4 parts. And I'll say, here's your topic. In this case, we're going to talk about a dog, what he looks like, what he does when I play with him, and how I take care of him. Now, this is where it blows your mind. I rip the paper in 4 parts, and we lay it on the desk. And I hand them what my dog looks like. That's all I want you to do on Monday. Give me some descriptions. If he needs it, scaffolding could be, give him a photograph. You've given him an image he can work from. Give him a word list. On Tuesday, what I like to do to play with my dog. On Wednesday, how do I take care of my dog? Now I've got the title at the top. Let's organize my paper. Do you want to start telling people about your dog by telling them how you clean up the poop in the yard and put food in his bowl? Probably isn't going to get your reader interested. But I give them a chance. All right, well, what would get people interested in reading about your dog? I let them choose. That's page 1. They go to the other 2, and finally we finish up with what takes care of my dog. Now I have them on Thursday write their rough draft using their sentences. On Friday, it's edit day, and I've broken that intimidating topic down to bite-sized pieces. With today's technology, you can do the same kind of thing on a computer, dividing your pictures into little shapes and typing into the shapes. That's what I meant when I say cut the pages in smaller parts. You may need to enlarge the answer spaces. That's an important one for kids who have handwriting problems. My granddaughter has a terrible problem writing long answers on her history assignments, mostly. So what her mom is doing is letting her give short answers. And there's no problem with doing that as long as she can talk with explaining what she's doing. So again, reduce the amount of writing as long as you get the content. Word banks are really helpful for students who have trouble with vocabulary, expressive language, or memory recall. It's in the short-term memory, but they can't seem to draw it back out to retrieve it. You all have gotten puzzle books from supermarkets and all that have a word bank at the top. Those are the words you go looking for. But as an aside, please do not ever give a kid with learning disabilities one of these crossword search puzzles where the words are written upside down, backwards, and diagonal. You will fry their brain. You can do word searches in other ways, but not that way. It's if they have any kind of visual issues with their learning disabilities, that's too much to find the words. But the word bank becomes that scaffolding that you've given them. Let's use these words to write about the Revolutionary War. Let's use these words to write about the attributes of rocks. So we've given them the words we want them to incorporate, but they don't have to worry about spelling. They don't have to get anxious about that. Next big trick, again, we're back to technology. We've already talked about the text-to-speech and speech-to-text. Get a picture of this. It's also in my book. I've got a whole chapter on technology. Inspiration and Kidspiration are super project areas where you can do that kind of thing that I was suggesting, where you create your ideas in a diagram and you can move them around to put them in the organizational sequence you'd like to have them in. Let them type. By age 10, if they're not really fluently writing, let them type. And my daughter did this with her son, and she said, if you can get up to 50 words a minute, I will let you start typing your papers instead of handwriting them, which made a huge difference. And using, as you suggested, the reading Ally audible books. One mom told me, I think it was yesterday, she has a son who has trouble with reading, but he loves to listen to audible books, and she says he wears out a pair of shoes every 3 months, walking the driveway, listening to stories all day long, because he wants the content, but he can't read it. So he's hungry to learn. Yes. The audiobooks are actually feeding the child at a level they can learn, and we don't limit them to the level they're reading, because if you're giving them second grade reading books, and they're hungry to learn at seventh or eighth grade content, you've put the lid on and you've squashed their interest in trying to develop. And that vocabulary exposure is another very important element. That's a good point. When you're going to use the computer technology, you need to be patient about it. And a lot of people like Dragon Speak, but I find Dragon Speak very hard to edit and very hard to use the controls. You have to say, stop, new line, and so on, which are extra commands that make it a little bit tricky. All right. I am running out of time, but this is one of the most powerful pieces, again, of individualizing instruction and teaching. I hate to do it, but I'm going to have to lead you to my book to finish the rest of this. Bloom's taxonomy was something that I learned. You're all familiar with the concept of a taxonomy in science, right? I mean, we classify animals, living things, by different attributes and so on. In the 1950s, a guy named Benjamin Bloom decided that he would analyze the levels of intellectual content that people did in thinking. And what happens when you do this, I'm going to come back to this slide again. What Bloom's did was he realized that there were different levels at which we can communicate and learn. And so he began to realize the most foundational level was knowledge. Think of a baby. They learn to talk by learning first words. They learn to make very short little facts and pieces of information. They move then to understanding what it's about when mommy says, put that back, bring that over here, the comprehension level begins to increase. And then we begin to ask them to apply it, analyze it, synthesize it, and evaluation. These bottom three are typically out of the realm of most kids with Asperger's and autism. They have difficulty applying, but they are monstrously good at facts. I mean, they are fact-based learners. Comprehension, they can often move forward and get some basic comprehension skills. But again, you're going to find, depending on the kinds of learning disabilities that are going on, they may have trouble retrieving words, they may have trouble explaining what they know. Application, you may show them how to go about doing it. But I want you to take this and understand that you can. There are charts that I have, and it's in my book, I believe. I don't think I have it here with me, but there's a chart. Let me show you how I use it. This would be questions that I would ask my child on a knowledge level. Tell mommy how many cars. List. Who were the five people in the story with the little Goldilocks? Describe. Can you show me? Show me. That would be not describe, but show me. It's a question. Can you tell me? Can you locate? Can you find? Show me. So these are things. But what I love about this particular chart, and I got permission from a gal in Australia who developed this version of the chart, is it gives you teaching activities to use at each level of Bloom's. So she's got a chart that shows how you can ask questions. So let's say you've got a high school kid and you're also talking together with all the students about a particular lesson that you're reading with them, and you've got the whole group together. You ask your younger child a knowledge question. You ask the not comprehension level, you ask maybe your fourth grader, can you explain that? So you each level asks, so you've taught the same lesson, but you're individualizing how you get the answers out of your kids. You take your older student who's in high school and say, can you justify why this was the right decision to enter this war? Not did we enter the war, that's a fact question, but can you justify that? Can you explain in reasons why you chose to go in that direction? So you're pushing the cognitive envelope as high as you can. But it's beautiful because you don't have to teach a separate lesson. You don't need a separate book. You change the level of your questioning. Okay? We talked about the rubrics. I gave you one. I'm going to have to leave you to figure that out on your own. This is a very simple one that I use for elementary kids for writing. Are your letters on the line? You'll get 1 point. If lots of your letters are over or under, but if all your letters are on the line, you've got 4 points. And at the end of the rubric, I would say 11 or 12 points, wow. 9 or 10 points, well, you need to go back and fix it. Write that line again. Good form, you can decide what that's ready to do. Even spacing, these are really on the line, even spacing and same size are about the three that really you can use to grade penmanship. Graphic organizers, I've hardly had time to even touch on those. This is another one of those where I talked about organizing, and you have that on the second page of your handout to show you how you can create graphic organizers for working in academic content and also using it for writing. You have big ideas. You may want to only use a couple of these, but there are lots of resources on there. The last item we want to cover very quickly, options to pencil and paper are so important for kids that are struggling learners. Get out of the model of thinking you've got to have pencil and paper to do school. There are ways. Let them give a speech. Let them create a little program. Let them show their sister how to do it. Think of other ways to do it. Don't be limited by just pencil and paper when you're going through measuring what they've learned. If you've got a rubric, you know what you're looking for. My husband's just graded 4,500 word essays for 20 students using a grading rubric from the university for graduate school. He knew what they were to contain so he could explain to the student why he got a 70. Unfortunately, one did. But he had the rubric to defend the grade. But for you, it's helping to keep track of what you want them to be able to do. So don't be afraid to think for alternatives to pencil and paper. Linking class, use art, models, technology, oral, hands-on activities. Okay? I hope I've given you some ideas that give you a chance to move out ahead of what you need to do to offer your child some special needs. All right, thank you all for the rest of your attention, and thank you so much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.